This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
When I pull up to the parking lot, it's time to level up. Dial in, showing out for your team. Listen up, get you some. I stand the fan to give you what you need. Fan fuel, game time. Turn up the intensity. Team colors bleeding now. 5 hour energy. For a limited time, get the fan fuel flavor at 5hourenergy.com.
It's a Football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Here's Payne and Pendergast.
7 o'clock hour. Good morning, everybody. In for Sean Pendergast, I'm Sean Bajani. Seth Payne here hanging out as well. Catch him on Twitter at Seth C. Payne, at Sean Bajani for myself. If you'd like to be a part of the show, hit us up 713-572-4610. The 5 hour energy fan line open as always. 5 hour energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610 and football super fans. Have some really good notes, nuggets, questions that I've logged, Seth, that we'll get to when we get back to some Texan topics, and we will do so here shortly. But yeah, last segment in headlines, you mentioned, I think, Bill Belichick, and I said we'd get to him, and we ran out a little bit of a time, so we'll get to him here. Bill Belichick in the news a little bit. As reports had come down over the last 24 hours that he has sought out, at least inquired about, the recent North Carolina opening as their head football coach. Obviously, Mac Brown canned a week and a half or so ago after 6 years with the Tar Heels. I had to do a double take on that. I was like, damn, Mac's been there 6 years. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
You thought
he might have, 6 years ago, you were wondering if he was just going to ride off into the sunset.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he's dancing with the players on your social media feed. Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, I didn't really foresee him being in the broadcast booth right after his days of Texas had ended, but he might very well be headed back there. Who knows? Bill Belichick might very well be headed back to a football field, but do you actually believe it would be on the collegiate level? According to reports and sources telling ESPN yesterday, Belichick's had discussions with UNC about the head coaching job. Sources also telling ESPN that Belichick wants to coach again and is open to listening to people at the collegiate and NFL level. Quick note, Freddie Kitchens, remember that dude? Former Browns coach, one of the many. He's serving now as UNC's run game coordinator and tight ends coach, and is effectively the interim head coach while they seek a replacement. Don't know if he's longer for the job than Bill Belichick, though it seems a little bit more realistic.
Yeah. I think UNC was probably a surprise to a lot of people because Belichick's name gets bandied about with Falcons or various other NFL teams, obviously. I think looking at it from Belichick's perspective, there's a couple things. One is that he's long had a respect for the, how do I phrase it, either smaller or less esteemed college programs. Mm. So he used to love getting players from Rutgers, you know?
Yeah.
He played at a small college as an offensive lineman. He always hired coaches and people like Nick Caserio that played at, you know, non-Division 1A level. He liked kind of, I think, the scrappy underdog element, the football junkie type of guys that are just trying to be in the business no matter what. So there's that where it's a little less of a shock to me, I think, than maybe it might be to others. But then the other is just, like, what do you do for a second act when you've already done something better than anybody else has ever done it before? You're not going to replicate what you did before.
Well,
you know, like, he's not going to go on to win six Super Bowls, or realistically.
Hold that thought, though. That was a similar question that people had with Tom Brady when he left New England. What do you do for a second?
Right.
You go to freaking Tampa Bay and you win a damn Super Bowl.
Yeah. Okay. Good question. Good point. Very, very good point. I think with Brady, though, I think he was still in that window of time where he felt like he could play good football. And what were his other options to go play football? So there's only so much he could do as a football player. And now that his football career is done, okay, he's going into broadcasting. He's going to see. So that's a good logical second act for a football player. It's laid out. What's the second act for a coach like Belichick, who, you know, had decades of extreme success on an NFL level? You know, he could go and like this. It almost feels in a little way like, okay, does he have to really go back and kind of put a stamp of authenticity on what he already did before by doing it without Tom Brady?
Yeah,
I don't know. I do think that. I think about actors who go on to Broadway or do any, you know, like maybe like Matthew Broderick was like a really successful movie actor when he was a young man. But then he ended up going into Broadway, and I'm sure he was financially just fine and everything, and he was very well respected for decades and decades as a Broadway actor. And I'm guessing Matthew Broderick is cool with that.
He let Sarah Seinfeld. Jessica Parker make all the money with Sex and the City.
Like Jerry Seinfeld, you know, has all that extreme success. And then what do you do after that? And it's been decades of kind of Jerry Seinfeld doing this, doing that. But he's not going to go back and try to do a sitcom. I think it makes a lot of sense for Belichick if, hey, you know, when you go into a quote unquote lesser college program and whatever the standard of success is, it's not going to be measured at by the same way, like even by Bill Belichick himself, as winning Super Bowls. So I think it might be way more appealing to him in some respects than the high profile jobs.
All right. So speaking of like second acts, I don't technically know which act this one would be, but Eric Bieniemy in the news this week, he was canned by UCLA, obviously the former Chiefs offensive coordinator. After getting passed over and passed over and passed over for head coaching opportunities in recent years, was the OC for UCLA. And now he is not. Indiana quarterbacks coach and co-offensive coordinator Tino Sunseri has agreed to replace Bieniemy after the college football playoff, and is now finalizing details, according to reports, of his new deal with the Bruins. UCLA stinker this past year, 5-7, did not become bowl eligible. Bieniemy's buyout, by the way, worth more than $1.2 million. I bring him up because, well, he's another big name. At least he used to be a big name, Seth, that is now out there amongst the others in both the NFL and collegiate ranks that's going to be looking for a job.
I think the funny thing about Eric Bieniemy is that, okay, for one, it became a very big race card thing that people would discuss, which, there was validity to asking the questions about, okay, why is this guy not getting the job and everything, and is it because he's black and because of this or that? I get the questions. I think people running with a certainty that they knew that, oh, he's not getting a head coaching opportunity because he's black, that's where people were irresponsible about it. And it all that kind of died down over the last couple years for a couple reasons. One is that a lot of other black head coaches were getting hired around the NFL.
Yep.
You know, by teams were accusing the Texans or anybody else for being racist for not hiring Eric Bieniemy. Well, they in the interim were hiring black head coaches. So I think that part of it kind of fell down. And then I think what started off as, well, he doesn't interview well, is the way it was politely being phrased.
Yes.
But then you start getting reports about, okay, him and Mahomes are really button heads, and wow, these interviews, when I say they didn't go well, they really didn't go well. Like, they were really bad. And he's got a history of off-field stuff that's very atypical for, and it's in the past, but it's atypical for guys that get hired to be head coaches. So everybody kind of backed off a little bit, and I think this is kind of what, I don't want to be irresponsible about it. They've mutually parted ways. I don't know why or anything else like that, but the shine is off of him as a prospect and as a poster child for, all that's wrong in society. I think people have kind of collectively realized, all right, there's more to a story here, and maybe I shouldn't be accusing people of being racist just because the outcome I want isn't being delivered.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that's always going to be there, no matter how many, I think, minorities are hired. You know, particularly in the NFL, it's just going to exist.
Right. Well, in general, like on the sum total of things, they're valid questions and they're valid concerns. It's that, but you can't take every situation and use it as evidence of racism.
Exactly.
Unless there's actual evidence of racism. And I see Stephen A. Smith bring it up a couple days ago, talking about what a joke the Texans were, and a black coach should never go to play for the Texans, or never go work for the Texans. When meanwhile, like, is there any danger of D'Amico Ryans getting fired anytime in the next 2 years? I would say the chance is almost zero that D'Amico Ryans gets fired by this team
yeah.
that was 2 years ago too racist to hire a black coach. As they were getting criticized, basically, for hiring too many black coaches. Because when you hire a black coach, at some point, if you're a coach in the NFL, you're going to get fired.
Yeah.
So the Texans made the mistake of continually hiring black coaches. They would then go on to fire them and then basically get criticized for hiring a black coach because they've had a black head coach or GM for the vast majority of the last 20 years, ever since 2006. When Rick Smith was hired, they've had either a black GM or a black head coach. And somehow they became the place that a black man should never go be a head coach or a GM.
Well, and
I don't get it.
Well, you know what started that was...
Well, yeah, I know, obviously it was all the Bob McNair stuff.
Bob McNair, and then it was exacerbated by, you know, Jack Easterby, Bill O'Brien cleaning everybody out and hiring a whole bunch of white people.
Right, but it was very, very easy for people to become white knights and the representatives of all that's good and holy just by bashing on the Texans for every little thing instead of just really examining what's going on.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Little sidebar here, but you mentioned D'Amico Ryans, and hey, look, this guy's not going to show up on any list for at least a couple of years about him being on the hot seat. I thought I heard you and Sean talk about this yesterday, and I was kind of getting out of the car, but... he was talking about, coaches that are showing up now with a hot seat. Like, who's next to be canned, you know? It's that time of year. We're starting to see teams make some decisions and hear reports and things like that. And I thought I heard him say that Dolphins head coach Mike McDaniel was on one of these lists. Like, now he's a little bit further down the list, not like top five or anything. But, you know, hey, look, it's Dolphins. And, you know, their struggles are more closely attributed to, Tua Tagovailoa not being healthy for about 5 weeks.
They've been a top five offense with Tua Tagovailoa this year.
Yes.
It's just the problem is that Tua Tagovailoa, he ain't always going to be there.
Right. But my point in bringing that up is like, okay, if these kind of inconsistencies and, real struggle to take the next step. And I mean, my God, we're in year two of the D'Amico Ryans era. I do feel like we at least have a couple of years before we need to have a conversation about this. But I mean, yeah, if there is anybody that is as safe in their job as could be that is not named Andy Reid or any Harbaugh at this point in time, it's probably D'Amico Ryans with their quarterback and the cornerstones that they do have on the defense.
Yeah, with D'Amico, I think over time, and this entire offseason, I think there will be a lot of scrutiny on D'Amico as, okay, is this a classic case of a defensive-minded head coach that can't deliver a good offense? That was the question about Belichick back in the day. Lovie Smith, that was a question when he was with the Bears. And that's what the narrative will be in the questions. And I think they're valid questions, especially when the chosen offensive coordinator is Nico's buddy and friend and kind of they're tied at the waist. So does D'Amico not have the stones to make a change there? Did he make the right choice? All of those things. I think those are fair, and it's all going to depend on what happens over the remainder of the season on into the playoffs.
100%. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani, in for Sean Pendergast this morning. 713-572-4610. You want to hit us up on the 5-Hour Energy fan line, Twitch, YouTube. Watch and join the chats there as well. D'Amico Ryans is not going to bat 1,000 from taking this job before last season to this point and beyond. It's just not. Like, his initial decisions, hires, draft choices, free agent acquisitions. At some point in time, it will be exposed. Maybe we're starting to see some light of that now in coaching decisions. Maybe we're going to start to see more light of that now in some personnel decisions with players on the field, to be more specific. But if he does bat 1,000, like, holy crap, Seth, like, this is going to be amazing. But it's just, it doesn't happen. Mistakes are made. And the real question is, as I kind of tie this back into what we've watched already this season through the first 13 weeks into this week 14 bye, is, hey, yeah, look, it hasn't been perfect, but are you good enough in other areas for that to supplement your shortcomings? So yeah, we've asked the question, what do we really need to see happen for this Texans team to improve? Did you see, and I'll start the conversation this way, did you see anything in that Jaguars game that was more of the same? You know, win's a win. Ugly, doesn't matter how you get it, a win's a win. Did you see anything that would give us any reason for added optimism as they go into this final stretch of the season?
I think in that game specifically, we didn't see Christian Harris, obviously. But I think with Azeez Alshire leaving the game, immediately you think, okay, well, boy, the Jaguars were smart. In the second half, they attacked the middle of the field. There's a lot of shorter and intermediate stuff underneath when you're depleted in the linebacking core.
Yeah.
Caserio bringing up Christian Harris a couple times in his press conference the other day makes me optimistic that Christian Harris will be back. So, at the very least, it's not a one-for-one swap. I think that Christian Harris does better as a Will linebacker and not as the Mike linebacker, but at least you're getting that athleticism back potentially. I think the biggest improvement, or at least sign, that I liked was the fact that the offense got it going in the second half. Mm-hmm. And they did it in a way where, agreed, you could see they tweaked the run game. They operated a little bit differently. And then when they were able to tweak the run game, it did open up some easier opportunities in the pass game. That's the thing that we just need to see more of. The offensive line play was better, way, way better than it was versus the Titans, better than it was versus the Lions. But those two defenses, the Titans and the Lions,
yeah,
are legitimately good defense, whereas, yeah, the Jaguars are not.
No, they're not. But here's the thing that I said before the Jacksonville game is, and it was kind of similar. You remember the vibe before the Texans played the New England Patriots? You know, there were some struggles there, inconsistencies then as there are now, maybe more so now than it even was before, because Texans were off to a really good start at that point in time before they hit that the Patriots game. And it was like, all right, well, you really got to get back on track here. You need to blow the brakes off the Patriots. Hell, you beat them by 20 points. But Seth, even then, we can't point to that game as the one where they'd played a full 60 minutes, so to speak.
Right.
You know, like, we can't point to that game as anything. I mean, you beat a really bad football team. Now, you beat them by 20 points, but my thought was, no matter what the Texans do, there are going to be questions after the Jacksonville game. But the one thing they can't do is lose to the Jaguars and lose back-to-back divisional games against far lesser teams than what they are and what they should be. And even though you got that dub, there are some things you can feel really good about. But the fact that you didn't do to the Jags what you at least did to the Patriots, I think, is the most concerning thing for, yeah, fans going forward.
You're right. You scored 23 points versus one of the worst defenses in the league. Mm-hmm. And that's the sum total of it all, is you don't have to make it overly technical or complicated. It's that they were not an offensive juggernaut. They did a lot better in the second half, but you didn't just lay the smackdown on them. And Bobby Slowick is still young as a coordinator. He's going to grow and learn. Theoretically, he would get better over time. But I think he's still, like, we haven't seen that version of Bobby Slowick that's going to really capture and get the most out of an offense. But he also does have, he's got challenges because the offensive line play has been so bad. Like, hey, we want him to spread it out more. That's cool. But, in college, you can spread it out. You can have really wide splits with your offensive line. And you can almost just, it's almost, you can get away with bad offensive line play because you can attack through the air before the defensive linemen get to the quarterback. In the NFL, you just face too many stud defensive linemen to really, if you don't have a good enough offensive line and you try to spread it out,
yeah,
CJ Stroud will get Trevor Lawrence'd. If you rely on Juice Scruggs to block Chris Jones one-on-one continually, he's going to get there, and it's hard to spread it out. But then when you try to condense everything and make it easier for the offensive line, then the teams are just, they smell blood in the water, and they're able to attack you, shut down the run game, and the offense hasn't been able to deliver on it. So a lot of that just starts with the offensive line. I think Juice Scruggs played well the other day, but I still don't trust him versus really good defensive tackles. I don't trust Shaq Mason versus really good defensive tackles. And I don't know how much of that can get fixed during the season with play calling or anything else. Other than, I think Bobby Slo can do a better job of giving quick options and outlets and hot routes and all of that. But they've just got certain challenges on the interior offensive line.
713-572-4610, the 5-hour energy fan line. From the 713, a few minutes ago, we got one of these. Hey, guys, great show. Question about the Texans is why they always seem to be a team. Listen to how he phrases this. They always seem to be a team willing and ready to be spoiled. It's a mindset. You have spoilers out there who win games they shouldn't, and the Texans seem to be the opposite side of that equation.
I don't I don't understand the question. Like, what is a spoiler?
Well, it says always willing to lose games they shouldn't. So,
yeah.
You know,
so I guess like the spoiler is like whatever the big play is on the other side of the ball or letting teams back into the game. Like that version of the word spoiler.
I think the Texans, like the Jags, let's take that game. Well, let's take the Titans game for instance, because that actually happened there. The spoiler in that game was the Titans. The Texans were supposed to win that game. They were favored by at least 7.5, I think, going into that game. Maybe the line even started at 8, 8.5, whatever it was. But what happened? Typical AFC South game. You know this. You've played in a lot of them. The line doesn't matter. They're ugly. They're gritty. They're close. And it's just an all-out fight. For whatever reason it is, and maybe you could say the same thing about any division game, but the Titans were the spoiler, and they beat the Texans. Why do the Texans always seem to be the team that gets spoiled, so to speak?
I think some of it comes down to what are your expectations of the Texans? And what exactly, like, obviously the ceiling that a lot of us put on the offense was way too high. We're now in the point where we're just hoping for competence out of the offense in any given week. So there's that. I mean, it's that I think the expectations were way too high, and that in some of these games that people consider spoilers, the Texans, they were within a half inch or a half point of the actual line on the game. They played it the way the game was expected by Vegas or the betting public to be played. So I think part of it is that. And then I think also, look, if you play the keep away game and if you're just going to try to maintain a lead, the defense has too many glitches in terms of allowing big plays, and then the offense just simply can't deliver at all. So, okay, you're trying to maintain a lead. What are you going to do? Just run the ball over and over again when you can't consistently run the ball over and over again?
Yeah.
Or defensively, all right, all we need is for guys to play their role, not bite on double moves, all these things. And yet they're not quite capable of delivering that. I think that's the biggest things that stick out in my mind in terms of the disappointing performances.
Yeah, well, and look, there have been disappointing performances, and even in wins. Like, and maybe we could have this conversation every year. I think we probably did even last year, as entertaining and as awesome as it was for the Texans, and God knows the expectations that most had for this team going into last year. It certainly wasn't 10-7 in a divisional round trip, you know, to the playoffs. But it's when you have expectations and you're literally talking Super Bowl and you feel as good about it as ever before in franchise history as we did this offseason, and then you see this. Well, that is something that's hard to kind of get back. But I contend, Seth, and it's not that this Jaguars victory taught me anything, but it's just the makeup of this team, that with Miami, Kansas City, Baltimore, and Tennessee remaining on your schedule and the position that you've put yourself in. It's kind of like I mentioned with the Rockets earlier. They stacked wins. You know, this team started 6-2. They put themselves in position, and only you can control yourself unless you play that divisional opponent, and the rest of the division has kind of helped you out in that matter. But you're in position now with a healthy quarterback, a running back in Joe Mixon that is, you know, doing some pretty historic things, to be quite honest with you. And the Texans, oddly enough, have found a way here in the last 3 weeks to even decrease his carries, and he's still giving you the production. You can cement yourself as still a legitimate Super Bowl contender with two huge quality wins out of the next four.
Right, right, yeah, and like, and they've slugged it out with good teams. That's the interesting dynamic of, okay, what, however you want to define what a spoiler is, or getting a team spoiling a victory, what have you. Mm-hmm. This is where it gets really, really frustrating. So the Texans, for one, they're 5-8 against the spread this year, so they've underperformed based on expectations. They started off the beginning of the season, you know, 3-1 in the real world. But 1-3 against the spread. So it just, you know, and we got the sense then versus Chicago, certainly versus Minnesota, and versus Jacksonville, that they weren't necessarily living up to expectations. Mm-hmm. But you look over the last half of the season that's been played so far, where they've underperformed or not lived up to expectations, starting with the Colts game. Even though they won, you know, they beat the Colts and it was a close game. They lose to the Jets. So obviously they lose against the spread and they just got outright upset.
Yeah.
They lost to the Titans. So, you know, they're against the spread and the disappointment. Whereas, hey, they beat the spread versus the Lions. The good teams that they played. They beat the spread versus Green Bay. Versus the good teams, they at least showed up and made it a competitive game. But versus these bad teams, they've just been not only losing the game, but obviously much, much, much underperforming based on expectations.
Hold on, so you're asking me to feel better about the fact that the Texans, you know, met or rather exceeded the level of expectation against the good teams via the spread. But,
yeah,
you know, vastly underperformed.
No. I'm not asking you to feel better about it. I'm telling you why it feels so bad.
Oh, okay.
It's that, like, because they didn't win those games either. Like, okay, yeah, they beat the spread.
And they should have.
They beat the spread versus the Packers and the Lions, but they still also ultimately let you down in those games.
Yes.
And you lost the game because of really annoying things. The decision-making in the game management at the end of the Packers game was infuriating. The Lions, you've picked off Jared Goff 5 times. Wow. 5 times you picked him off, and you couldn't win that game.
Yeah.
And yet you still also beat the spread in that game. But then you go into games like the Jets, the games like the Titans. They should be slam dunk. Like, of course you're going to win those games outright.
Yeah.
Maybe they lose the spread, but, like, no, they lost the spread, and they got beat physically in those games.
What would have been worse, right? All right, so we know the Texans lost to the Lions, in which, as you mentioned multiple times, picked off Jared Goff 5 times.
Right.
All right. Well, we almost saw Jameis Winston win a football game this past week after having thrown 2 pick-sixes, like 6 total touchdowns in that game, but 2 to the other team. Like, if he would have found a way to win that game, like, who's feeling worse in that moment? Like, the Texans for having still lost to the Lions after forcing 5 interceptions, or the Broncos if they would have lost that game to the Browns the other night?
Well, the Broncos at least makes sense, whereas, okay, Bo Nix has performed way better than I thought he would. Kudos to Sean Payton for getting the performance they've gotten out of Bo Nix this year. But at least it still would have felt, it would have felt like it made sense on the sum total of things. And Jameis Winston, we know this. We know this from firsthand experience when the Texans faced Jameis Winston last in Tampa, that it's a double-edged sword with Jameis Winston. Man, he can throw for 30-plus touchdowns in the same season that he also throws 30-plus interceptions. So
crazy.
That at least makes more sense. It makes more sense than losing to whatever version of Aaron Rodgers he is right now and that Jets team. That would have made zero sense whatsoever. And it did, and it still doesn't to me. The fact that the Texans played the way they did versus the Jets.
Without Devontae Adams, right? That was
right.
Yeah, that stings even more, man. God bless America. 713-572-4610, 572-4610. So things that really need to happen for this Texans team to improve. I know you wanted to talk a little bit about Jalen Petrie and C.J. Stroud needing to flip a switch. I'm going to frame this question like this. What's more likely to happen? Jalen Petrie returns inside at some point over the course of the next month into maybe the postseason, or C.J. Stroud flips said switch. And I think there's probably the response to that is more multifaceted than an injured player returning to play.
Right, yeah. I think with C.J. it depends on so many other things. And I don't, like, I'm not 100% convinced that C.J. has to flip a switch. I think some of the things that I wanted more of earlier in the season, I think he started to do a really good job of hitting his checkdowns, like taking the easy money on early downs, all those things. I think he's made progress. It's just, can the rest of the offense keep pace? The return of Nico Collins has made a big difference in that, to the surprise of nobody. Jalen Peachy's the big one where, look, last night we're watching the Lions. Frank Ragnow, the center, he's been playing with a partially torn pec all year long. Mm-hmm. We've seen T.J. Watt come back from a partially torn pec a couple of years ago. J.J. Watt was a different scenario because he actually had the surgery and then came back over 2 months later. So the timeline that makes me most optimistic is the center, Frank Ragnow, for the Lions, who's been – he missed 2 weeks early in the season. And the timeline is almost – it matches up perfectly with the Texans because – he missed 2 weeks, but one of those was a bye week, so he missed one game total. So for Jalen Petry, who theoretically doesn't need to use his pec as much as a center who has to use it every single play versus really large human beings, that's the one that's given me the most hope for that. I also think that the fact that the Texans haven't yet placed him on IR, Petry on IR, gives me some hope because he would have been... he's gotten his second opinion. There would have been time to make a decision on shutting him down for the season. So I think there's still I'm allowing myself to maybe hope for that right now.
I think that's a really good breakdown and some good points by you. And just to clarify, ask you a question, like that particular type of injury, you know, with a slightly torn pec or even a fully torn pec, like that's something you can kind of tinker with in terms of like, all right, let's rehab this first and see where we get. Mm-hmm. And if it's not working, there's still enough time with an off season to get that surgery and recover in time for the beginning of next season.
Well, and even if, and I guess I'm more optimistic because if they had thought, okay, this is serious, but we want to, you know, we think there's a chance he might be back for the playoffs, slap him on IR immediately, knowing that it's going to take at least 4 weeks, where now it's okay. Let's wait and see because maybe he can be back inside of 4 weeks and we don't want to handcuff ourselves with that.
Yeah. I could totally see that. That's going to be something that is interesting. I hadn't really thought about it in that regard. The Texans not putting Petry on IR just yet. But
and the first thing that people will say when I bring that up is like, hey, man, Petrie's tackling hasn't always been the best. What do you think about him out there? I'm like, well, okay. I think his technique on tag, he still missed tackles this year, but his missed tackle rate is about the same as it was last year. His tackling technique has definitely improved. And I think the variety or the version of missed tackles he's had this year haven't been as maybe infuriating, I guess, partly just because of the position he plays.
Well,
so
yeah.
I think that if you get some bad tackling out of him, so be it. It's a better option and alternative if it means that Jimmy Ward moves back to safety and you see less Eric Murray.
You know, we had John McClain on. We have him on every Wednesday on our show, Area 45 at night. And, you know, for the last couple of weeks, you know, we found ourselves kind of talking about the amount of explosives that the Texans have allowed in the air. They've given up, I don't know what the number is now, probably beyond 20 touchdowns in the air this season versus fewer than that all of last season. And the reason why I bring that up is like, okay, well, Jalen Petry, a lot of those times was one of those dudes on the island that had gotten burned, was giving up some touchdowns, you know, last season, and even at times earlier this season. And the missed tackles certainly exacerbate, like, you know, the shortcomings of some of his play and how aggressive or maybe overly aggressive he is and has been. But I feel like we've got a better... We like the play of Jalen Petry more now because, well, he's used differently this season.
Yeah.
And so even though he's found himself on an island, it's really the larger concern here is the Texans secondary and why they've been so susceptible to allowing explosives that have gone for six defensively this year. Petry hasn't been that poster child like, yeah,
right.
It's him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, and a lot of that is just simply, yeah, when you're playing true safety, especially when you're playing free safety or deep center field safety, you're the last line of defense. Or if you bite on a double move and the back end of the defense, then you're really screwing the whole play up. He's not in that position as much anymore. And then the plays like versus Davante Adams in the Jets game, that's what we've known since training camp. I was, during training camp, I just kept thinking, okay, well, look, they can't be planning on him being up in man coverage at the line of scrimmage versus guys like Tank Dell or Stephon Diggs, right? Lo and behold, yep, they did. That's how they used
him. Yeah, who was who did he wind up on in a game?
Davante Adams in that Jets game. Golly. Yeah. Mm. So there's that part of it, but that's not, I don't blame Jalen Petrie for that. I blame the Texans for putting him in that position and relying on him in that role. Yeah. That's where some of those plays that we've had when Jimmy Ward's not out there.
Yeah.
We love Kalen Bullock and his upside and everything that for a rookie, I think he's doing awesome. When it comes to kind of some of the veteran savvy type of stuff, you go over to the Cowboys game. I don't think Kalen Bullock was in the wrong position or wrong on that play because Okuda wasn't, by the letter of the law, Okuda was supposed to just not give up the inside on that play.
Right.
And that's the way Kalen Bullock was playing behind it.
Yeah, and where did Okuda turn his hips? Immediately. To the outside.
Right. And he gets beat to the inside, but Okuda, even though by the book it's not his fault that it ends up going for a touchdown, I think with a veteran guy like Jimmy Ward back there, Jimmy Ward recognizes the mistake and the error in the weak spot in the defense quicker and maybe could have saved it. Likewise, Kalen Bullock wasn't technically in the wrong on that long run in the Jaguars game, but I think a veteran safety recognizes the soft spot in the mistake and perhaps gets leverage on it even sooner. Even though Kalen Bullock ended up hawking that down, there's the part of being a safety isn't just knowing your role. It's making everybody else right. And I think Jimmy Ward just has a better feel for stuff like that.
You know, I get crushed sometimes because I say this, and not just on the radio and stuff, but just to people, that the Jimmy Ward effect, I felt this way last year, and I'm even more confident in saying it this year because he's been more available to them on the field. And I want to knock on wood because I've actually been impressed by Jimmy Ward's availability for the Texans this year. He's already exceeded my expectations, but the pre-snap stuff, the communication from Jimmy Ward to other players, he is just literally another, he's a linebacker out there. He's another coach on the field, so to speak. He just gets guys lined up, and he talks about it all the time. That's one of the most transparent guys. I love listening to him on the post-game shows. But yeah, maybe he doesn't fix like the pre-snap technique of Okuda, but maybe he says something to him like, hey, watch this, or make sure you don't do this.
Yeah, whatever you do.
Yeah, whatever you do. Like, you know, the at the snap of the ball, don't immediately in an 8-yard cushion flip your hips to the outside and give up the middle. You know what I'm saying? Like what
by
happened.
By a receiver who's got 200 yards receiving on the season going into that game, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. That was killer, man. But I think the Jimmy Ward
Okuda, man. Okuda, boy. Okuda was the guy I allowed myself to get excited about, or at least maybe think, okay, maybe there's upside here. Maybe the D'Amico glow up works or what have you, and so far it hasn't worked out that way.
Has not worked out. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning. Coming up next, we talked about this a little bit earlier, Seth, in regards to the reported offer to Alex Bregman that the Astros have made, and MLB.com has confirmed via sources as of yesterday, a 6-year, $156 million offer. I want to know that outside of that contract, we're hearing more about plan Bs and contingencies. What do Astro fans actually feel about that situation? It doesn't feel like they're about to make an Astro lifer out of Alex Bregman. Do we like any of the contingencies? We'll discuss next at Sports Radio 610.
It's a Football Friday on Sports Radio 610. Live from the Twin Peaks Studios, here's Payne and Pendergast.
Seth Payne and Sean Pendergast in for Sean Pendergast. I'm Sean Bajani. Pretty good to be with you this morning, man. Thanks for joining us, listening on the radio, all the platforms. If you got the free Odyssey app, thank you. You are wise for downloading that free app. You can take us anywhere and everywhere you go. If you're hitting us up on Twitch and the YouTube streams, thank you. A lot of reaction from Texans stuff already this morning, and we got you till 10, so plenty more to go and get to in regards to that. 713-572-4610. You can hit us up on the phone lines or the 5-Hour Energy fan text line. 5-Hour Energy, the official energy shot of Sports Radio 610. Seth, shot in the arm, shot in the ass. I don't know how you felt about the 6-year, $156 million offer. Was it insult or intrigue for Alex Bregman?
I still think it's intrigue. I think that, for one, look, Bregman, we go through this every year with Bregman. Every year. It's if he's in the middle of one of his droughts, you're wondering and you're frustrated, why? And then all of a sudden, when he turns it around and he's performing like an MVP caliber player, you're like, oh, yeah, that's just Bregman. That's what he does. Hey, it's no big deal. And especially then if he performs in the playoffs that year, like, oh, yeah, you can live through the droughts. But it's something on the sum total of things that you got to look at and consider if you're a team that's going to bring him on. The fact of the matter is, Bregman shares the same agent as Matt Chapman. Matt Chapman got a deal that was $5 million less, but Chapman's a year older. But their numbers are very similar in a lot of regards. And that was a deal to keep Chapman on the team that he was with. And this is also $1 million more than Altuve's record-breaking deal for the Astros. Yeah. The Altuve deal's the biggest deal the Astros have given out. And it's 1 year longer than anything the Astros have ever done before. So I don't know. It still might not be what Bregman is looking for, but I'd have a hard time if I'm Bregman feeling insulted by that offer. He knows this organization well enough to know that they operate a certain way. He's watched his friends Carlos Correa and George Springer and Charlie Morton or whomever else leave, and without getting an offer anything similarly competitive to what his is. So I don't think this is a no-brainer. Oh, no way in hell he's gone. And until I hear of an offer from another team that would render this deal insulting, then I can't imagine that he looks at it as an insult.
713-572-4610. We got this from the 713. Jim Crane is a bad owner without Jeff Luhnow. We know this, and the only reason we got our last championship is because Jeff Luhnow. It wasn't because of the owner or anything anybody else did. No faith in the Astros. He doesn't know how to spend his money. Jim Crane.
We know, for one, I'll say, we know for sure that Jim Crane is a bad GM when he's an interim GM. We know he was a bad interim GM. I have a hard time saying that Crane's a horrible owner because of the guy he hired and allowed to do, and stood by the guy he hired for several years of being lambasted as the worst owner in baseball. That takes a certain level of brass balls that I don't think people understand. I don't think people understand how hard that is to do.
Yeah.
To just take all the slings and arrows that come with tanking and to stick it out. You can't have it both ways. You can't say Jim Crane's an owner because the guy he hired and allowed him to do his work was actually the guy that was good. That's not the way the world works.
Yeah.
So it's somewhere in between.
I'm constantly intrigued by the unwavering confidence. Every year about this Astros team not worrying about letting key pieces, glue guys, heart and souls of the team, so to speak, flat out legends, maybe, in Alex Bregman's case, walk. The potential, like, is this going to be the one that bites him in the ass? You know, Springer, it worked out. Correa, it's worked out. Garrett Cole, seemingly it's worked out. Would you like to have Garrett Cole? Yeah, sure. But you feel pretty good about what the Astros have been able to do, from a pitching standpoint and some of the young guys coming up. I saw this last night from Michael Schwab on Twitter. Quote, apparently the Astros have checked in with the Cubs about trading for Cody Bellinger. That's per Bruce Levine from 670 The Score. Bellinger has a $26 million tax hit and a player option in 2026. It seems like a backup plan to add a bat if the Astros can't sign Bregman. I've heard the Bellinger thing before. Like, people have thrown that out there. Maybe now it's catching a little bit more traction. And I was going to say I don't know why, but I do know why. Well, the offer's out there. It's been reported, and so that would leave me to believe that, it's not exactly what Bregman and Boris want, so the Astros have got to be pivoting. There's multiple different ways that they can go here, Seth, and me and Patrick Creighton on Area 45 have talked about kind of the doomsday scenario where it's a soft reset. That would be a doomsday scenario, I think, in our mind, because, well, Bregman, that domino falls. Well, maybe you think about trading Fromber. Maybe you think about trading Kyle Tucker. Maybe you're going to unload Ryan Pressly, and you're going to build through the draft and get some young guys in and all that stuff. But there's a contingency, and the key word here is contingency, not a plan B. Contingency, in my mind, is a word that intimates the Astros actually still wanting and thinking that they can contend for a World Series, as opposed to a simple, well, here's our plan B and this is what we're going to do, a soft reset. Right.
I think with, for one, Cody Bellinger, boy, I'd be disappointed, man. I feel like as much as this team has done to, at least locally, you know, and I think throughout baseball, they've, in baseball itself, the being better than everybody else scandal is long past in the rearview mirror. Most people in baseball don't give a single damn about it. But Bellinger, man, it just brings all of that back. And I don't know. Maybe there would be some kind of healing element to it or whatever. I think with Bregman, the biggest part of it that you forget on the sum total of everything, the things that aren't the eye-popping conventional stats that he brings to the table. One, the competitive at-bats. You know, when it comes to competitive at-bats and all the stats that go along with it, like his chase rate, his whiff percentage, strikeout percentage, like all these things, he's elite in that regard. Mm-hmm. And like that's something that whether he's slumping or not, that he adds to your lineup.
Yeah.
And then defensively, I mean, a lot of regards, this last season was the best defensive season he's ever had. And that was with gremlins in his elbow for a good portion of the season.
And it wasn't a good start to the season defensively for Bregman either.
Yeah.
Because as much as he was struggling at the plate, he was missing some plays in the field that he typically made, but he put it all together.
Yeah, it was the highest. I think it was the highest run value he's had as a defender in his entire career. So, like we've been spoiled with that. We've been spoiled with really, really good defense at third base. We've been spoiled with competitive at bats by a guy who is very streaky and prone to slumps. That's harder. I don't think you replace that in one fell swoop. It's going to be a hodgepodge of, oh, you bring in whether it's Bellinger or somebody else that can do something for you offensively.
Jorge Polanco's been a guy who's been mentioned. Willy Adames, but a lot of teams are in on him. I just saw reports. I'm sure all of you have as well, that the Yankees were looking at the free agent shortstop Willy Adames, maybe as somebody they could move over to third. If, in fact, the Astros would be in on him. But those, to me, are real contingencies. Mm-hmm. The plan B is, okay, here's our plan A. It's to retain, you know, a guy that we think we can contend and win a World Series with here in the next couple of years. But the plan B shifts away from, like, okay, well, let's see what this fella Shea Whitcomb can do over there at third base. Or maybe let's bring a old farmhand back in and Josh Rojas and, you know, see if we can do something there. But to me, it's not even as black and white as that, because if you went plan B at third base, doesn't mean you're going plan B as a team, because you could significantly and should even still look to improve first base. You cannot go into spring training with John Singleton being even a platoon option, in my opinion, on a World Series contending team this year. Can't happen.
Yeah.
That would be disastrous, I think, and a thorn, maybe two thorns in the side of Astros.
Sorry, don't make
fans.
Me think about first base, Sean.
I didn't mean to, but it is there. He's Seth Payne, Sean Bajani in for Sean Pendergast this morning. Coming up next, we'll hit the 8 o'clock hour, the aftermath of Aziz embracing the villain role. You down with that? We'll discuss next.